My special guest today is Professor Malcolm Hopwood, who is President of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. Thank you for your time today, Professor.
Good afternoon.
Let's talk a little bit. You've written an article for us for MJA Insight on the stigma of mental illness as portrayed in the media. Talk to me a little bit about how you see the situation in Australia at the moment with that topic and what can be done to make it better.
Well, I think as a college we are happy that there has been some improvement. So over the last decade, mental illnesses like depression, anxiety, are generally presented in a much more favourable light. That's less true of illnesses like schizophrenia, other psychotic disorders. But we remain concerned that actually the treatments are still discussed in some very odd and stigmatising ways.
Can you give us an example?
Well, there are some obvious examples like hospitalisation or treatments like ECT, but even the way our medications are discussed is a bit odd. So if you think, for example, from cancer medicine, we all accept that chemotherapy will have side effects. Hair will fall out, you'll feel nauseous and so on. And we understand that as a reasonable thing. Yet when we have discussions about psychotropic medications, their side effects are discussed in isolation, as if they're being used almost solely for that purpose. So we're prescribing drugs that make people sleepy or overweight, and their positive benefits are really not mentioned. Well, now, why would you do that? And would that make you, as a reader of that article, think, I want to go and seek treatment for my problem?
Is there a feeling that from the media, perhaps, that we're relying too much on antidepressants, that perhaps they're being prescribed too much? And
I think that discussion does occur, and I think that's a reasonable discussion.
Yeah.
And we would support an active and logical discussion about what are the most appropriate treatments for each condition. But actually, it's not that other treatments, options or other possible courses are discussed in a more positive light. So talking therapies are sometimes seen as a nicer alternative, but some of the discussion about them can be quite stigmatising. Why would you go and talk to someone? You can't trust them. They don't really have your best interests at heart. They're all a bit weird, is a kind of suggestion at times. You don't talk about other specialties that way, do you?
Is it a particular portion of the media that you think's doing this, or is it a widespread problem?
I would like to say it was localised to one sector or even one publication, for example, but I don't think that's true. I think if we look across film, television and written media, electronic media, we see lots of discussion of psychiatric hospitals as dangerous places. Patients who are there are dangerous people. Sometimes the psychiatrists are termed to be dangerous people. And that the treatments they administer are often portrayed in a very out-of-date way. We have great concerns where ECT is often depicted in the manner that it was delivered in the 1940s and the 1950s.
One flew over the cuckoo's nest.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
No one would show you cardiac surgery the way it was done in the 1940s and the 1950s and imply that it's still done the same. Why do we do that with psychiatric treatments? I really don't know.
What can we do to combat it?
Well, I think we as a college feel we've got a strong role in pointing it out when it occurs. We collaborate with a number of the consumer and carer organisations like SANE that run a strong Stigma Watch campaign and call people to task. We do find that some of them respond and go, gosh, I hadn't thought about what I was doing. Thank you for pointing it out. And who do amend their behaviour? I wouldn't say it always works. That wouldn't be true. I think traditionally mental health professionals have been a little reluctant to go forth and say, look, you've just got that wrong.
Yeah.
Well, we want that to change.
What about in particular the media discussions about suicide? There have been a lot of guidelines put out for media about that. Are you happy with the way that's going?
Look, I have to say that's one area where I think there has been significant improvement. So those guidelines that talk about not overly discussing the particular means of suicide in order to reduce the potential for copycat activity, that's generally adhered to pretty well, together with those bits of information that often follow about access to services like Lifeline. So I actually think that's one area where people are managing relatively well. There are exceptions, but relatively well, and that's pleasing. We would like some similar respect for issues around treatment. At the end of the day, the value of that information should be in helping people access proper care. And we're very concerned that the way it's discussed, it actually has the reverse effect and makes them think, why would I want that? That's definitely not what we need.
You've also written an editorial for our mental health issue of the MJA, talking about whether or not Australia's ready for national screening of depression. And you came to the conclusion that perhaps we're not ready yet. Why not?
It's a very good question. We've certainly seen quite a lot of international debate about this issue, and some recent US guidelines suggesting it may be time. In Australia so far, we've really only done screening for selected high-risk populations, recent mums, some special Indigenous and other populations. And that may well be appropriate where we know there's a high risk. Interestingly, some recently released US guidelines follow up the recommendation for screening by saying screening is just that and not a replacement for good clinical assessment. It's certainly a concern that if screening were to be made mandatory, good clinical assessment just wouldn't happen. Good clinical assessment can be augmented with screening tools. We're having a lot of change as well currently in the clinical, particularly primary care, mental health workplace. And I think a lot of us are kind of not quite sure how all those changes are going to work their way through. So our stance currently is let's get that sorted, make sure access to good care is equitable, is easily accessible and understandable to everyone who needs it. When we've got that right, screening may assist.
It's sort of similar to the space around domestic violence at the moment. It's one thing to screen for domestic violence or whatever, but it's another thing to have the resources to be able to offer the patient.
Yeah,
at the end
it's
of the
a
day.
Very interesting comparison, and that's absolutely right. We were talking just a moment ago about the destigmatisation of depression in our community and the encouragement of people to seek care, and that's a wonderful thing that we would support strongly. But if you present for care and the care's not available or less than ideal, that may be not just a neutral or not helpful experience, it may actually be a negative experience and put you off presenting for help the next time the problem arises. One of the issues we have been advocating about recently is physical health in people with serious mental illness. So the data is very clear now, including good Australian data. People with disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in Australia die 15 to 20 years younger than their peers.
Wow.
Now that's an extraordinary gap. I suspect most people's first reaction is, well, I know those disorders carry a high risk of suicide, and that is a major issue. But in fact, the vast majority of the premature mortality is due to poor physical health, particularly diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and to a lesser degree, lung disease.
Is that a socioeconomic thing?
Well, we don't think it's just that. There are probably a range of factors that contribute. Of course, around those metabolic disorders, people often point their finger directly at the role of medication. And that probably has a role, but there's also things like poor diet, which may go with socioeconomic circumstance, lack of exercise, smoking rates, which we know are well in excess of the community, poorer capacity to access good physical health care, and then poorer capacity to utilise it well. And at times, when they do present, people with major mental illness I'm talking about now, do present for physical health care, not receiving the same standard of care as others do. That's a difficult topic.
Yep.
But it's one, unfortunately, we still see lots of examples for.
People are scared, aren't they, of people with mental illness?
I think so. And spending a little bit of extra time explaining what's going on and what's needed and engaging well in decision-making can be very fruitful. If we think about what we stand to gain from better physical health care in people with mental illness, we could actually make a very big difference at a population level if we do this right.
College has been very strong in its support of the LGBTI community. Tell us a little bit about mental health in that community and what the problems are.
Yes, quite happy to do so. So the college has recently released a statement around mental health issues in the LGBTI community. And the facts are pretty clear. Being gay in our community is associated with a 14 times higher risk of suicide attempts and a threefold increase in risk of mood or anxiety disorders. Now, there are probably many factors that contribute to that, but we think it's really important that data's out there and people acknowledge that ongoing stigmatisation and inappropriate debate over issues like same-sex marriage may make those figures worse.
It was interesting, the recent debate about the safe schools. It really stirred up a lot of anger and fear, and a lot of that returned to kids feeling like they're freaks and not safe.
So a very important part of that debate was the initial driver for the program. So debates about the content of the program aside, the driver for the program was a recognition that kids who are gay are at risk of being harassed, mm-hmm. bullied at school, and those data would suggest they're already at high risk of mental health problems. That's just not good enough. And within that debate, we would feel very strongly that that fact needs respect. We're very conscious that these often provocative and controversial issues are debated in a safe and respectful way. We're equally concerned about some of the recent debate that's occurred around transgender people
yeah.
and gender reassignment surgery, including comments that suggest that gender reassignment surgery may be associated with worse mental health outcomes than not having surgery. We feel very strongly that that's an incorrect interpretation of the available data. The available data clearly shows that people who are transgender are at increased risk for mental health problems, and that effective surgery reduces that risk. And we think misquoting of that data is not just mischievous, but potentially hurtful.
Thanks so much for your time.
Ah, pleasure.